Good day, everybody. This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. Today we have a panel dealing with issues on developing microgrids and or community solar on brownfield. And we have four different presenters. Linda, is that you? Oops, wait a second, Linda. I've got to unmute you. Hang on here. Okay. Linda, I'll have you talk last then since you just arrived. We're going to have Jerry Braun talk from Integrated Resources Network, Shalom Flank from Microgrid Architect, Cleaner Rob, a Christian and Barton, an attorney, and Linda Shaw, also an attorney. And so, Jerry, why don't you start us off with a couple minutes of just the conversation starter here.
Okay. I'll do that. I just was about to say that here in Davis, California, in the 1980s, we actually did a community solar project on a brownfield site. We didn't realize we were doing it at the time. It was really a major system research facility funded by PG&E and the Department of Energy and a whole lot of other utilities. But it was on a brownfield site, a wastewater treatment plant that had been shut down, and it's still there. And there are now plans to, to expand the facility. It was about a megawatt worth of solar PV. It expanded to maybe 10 or 15 megawatts. And it really could be the hub of a local microgrid, although that there's been no planning in that direction. I think the key thing is that having done something, it led to a lot more. We took an inventory of all the sites in around our city to see where we could put solar and where it would fit best, and that's something that really needs to be looked at carefully from a community solar perspective. So I'll just leave it at that. We have a little bit of experience, and it triggered a lot of good initiative once we had done the project.
Okay. Sean, do you want to talk a little bit about what's going on over your area, which is in New York?
Sure. So Jerry, thank you. And I think the PV story is obviously a big focus for brownfields, but I wanted to address a different side of things, which is microgrids and in particular kind of district energy approaches, which requires some significant kind of central plant construction. And in that context, brownfields can be a great opportunity. What you often find, not universally, but a lot of the brownfield opportunities are in an urban context, and they tend to be kind of the last land developed in a given area because of the extra complications and liabilities and so forth. So that land tends to be available for siting microgrid facilities for projects that would otherwise struggle to find the real estate to be able to put that equipment. It kind of creates an automatic back of the house area for sites that otherwise might not have a suitable location. It also means the land tends to be a little cheaper, although there's obviously costs that go with it, but of course there's various sources of funding to help address those costs. It also means that, again, in the non-PV context, if you're doing something like combined heat and power, maybe with biomass or waste to energy or straight natural gas with all of the heat recycled, you can sometimes, not always, but sometimes get some public opposition on the basis of the local emissions, even though it reduces emissions overall. That tends to be less the case when you're actually helping to remediate some of the environmental hazards that are associated with brownfields. And it's just kind of a public association of that particular site with something that's going to have some modest environmental impact. And so you wind up with less of that local opposition and more support for turning that land into a productive use. And there's also some really interesting urban planning implications, but I think I will hold off on that, and we can come back to it in the conversation.
All right. Kleena, what's happening over in your area?
Well, this is renewables, and it's Virginia, so to some extent we're unique and different. Community solar is just taking some baby steps. Senate Bill 1393 got passed in the 2017 General Assembly session, and it follows the usual pattern of we get renewables in Virginia if the utilities do them, and it's harder to get what some of the distributed solar folks are calling true community solar. If you Google community solar in Virginia, you're going to get to Dominion Virginia Power's website. That'll tell you that the legislation was the successful outcome of a solar collaborative work group consisting of Dominion Energy, Appalachian Power, the state's electric cooperatives, and other interested stakeholders. And that description kind of tells you that if you've got a collaborative work group, consensus-driven, that's got a lot of the utilities on it, then what comes out of that group is a utility-centered approach to community solar. So what's happening is Dominion, the big utility in the state, is about to put in a proposal to our regulatory commission, the State Corporation Commission. Basically, they're going to solicit RFPs for other folks to build the solar, but then the utility will own the solar and will put interested ratepayers on a schedule that draws from that solar facility. But it's not, as my distributed solar folks tell me, it's not true community solar in that, and that might be something to explore later on in this conversation, is what's considered community solar. But my distributed solar friends tell me that it really needs to be owned by the community, and that's not going to be the case here. The one interesting aspect of the project, which everybody seems to like, is that it's been praised for focusing on economic development benefits. So we're not focusing on brownfield, but we are focusing, basically the RFPs are coming in, and there's going to be special consideration given to those projects which provide economic development benefits. So that includes using sources within Virginia, and again, that's kind of new because we've not always been very good about encouraging renewables in Virginia itself. But they're also going to give special consideration to local economic benefits. That includes the workforce training, job creation, and for projects that are in economically depressed areas, including revitalization areas. So that's, I think, really the most interesting aspect of the project. I'm not sure you can consider it a traditional community solar project, but to the extent that it focuses on economically depressed areas, I think that's probably the most interesting aspect of the proposal. That's all I've got, Sierra.
Okay. That's quite a bit, actually, especially in Virginia. So, all right, Linda, I think you're here.
Yeah.
And you want to go ahead and talk about what you're interested in talking about and also what's going on in your area? She's the one who kind of initiated this conversation. So.
Yeah, well, in I do most of my work in New York, although I'm in New Jersey at the moment, so a little bit happening in New Jersey as well. So far, New York has been slower than, frankly, New Jersey and some other places. It has been difficult on many levels. A lot of the environmental groups have been fighting solar, which makes no sense to me, but they have. And what mainly has happened in New York over the last 10 years is an effort to try to first make it easier to do these projects on large brownfields and in particular landfills. through our state seeker process, which is the New York equivalent of NEPA at the federal level. So we have an environmental review process for any project over certain sizes, and any obviously you need about 5 acres for a 1 megawatt facility. So that triggers our New York NEPA. And one of the things DEC has done, since they're sympathetic, or that's our state environmental agency, is to make a solar on a brownfield / landfill site a positive environmental impact project that does not require an environmental review. That helps because it lowers the upfront cost. One of the things in New York that's always difficult is the upfront approval process cost. We also looked at our building code and realized that the building code needed to be more standardized because each little municipality has their own rules. So that's another thing New York has done. There have been a few solar on brownfield projects done in the state, but they're, you know, both the state and NYSERDA, DEC and NYSERDA would like to see more because we have 1,700 closed landfill sites, and they are currently being looked at again for new emerging contaminants. In fact, that's why I'm down here in New Jersey. There's sort of new contaminants that are becoming known to be hazardous to our health, and DEC is going back to look at these old landfills, and one of the things everybody is concerned about is, okay, well, if there's a problem, who's going to pay for the recapping of that old landfill? And the fit between brownfields and solar is that the solar developer can come in and maybe put a nice new impermeable soil cover underneath their panels. Now, that adds, obviously, to cost. And you know, these projects are already pretty economically difficult when you have to add any cost when it comes to the preparation of the site for you know, a project of this nature. And so what New York also has is a brownfield cleanup program that provides significant tax credits. And if you bundle those with the remaining federal incentives, you can potentially do a project, provided the utility is going to facilitate that through some type of, you know, purchase power agreement. I know I've been personally trying to do this type of project on a number of brownfields for about 10 years through this company I created, Future Energy, and have not yet been successful. I've gotten close a number of times, but very often the utility, you know, is either doesn't want to help with the interconnection, or the costs are just still too high, even with the brownfield incentives. But I'm getting closer, you know, because there are, like I said, a number of things diverging at the moment and coming together. This new landfill initiative may prompt the need for municipalities to actually pay for some of the capping, and then attracting the solar developer who would then pay for the maintenance of the site, which is a common continued cost on their part. So that those are the kind of models we're starting to see develop, but I have to say it's still new. And, you know, we're still in competition with wind and, you know, the general power plants that are out there, which at the moment still are providing enough power, enough power to the grid. So it's still a very tight economic situation in many of these sites. A lot of things have to come together. The connection to the grid has to be real close to make it work, and there can't be a lot of infrastructure costs on that end. But there are some opportunities out there that are coming into, you know, into light with I think public-private partnerships that are going to start to form with these old landfill sites.
Anybody have any thoughts or comments on that?
Hi, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Shalom. I have a question for Linda.
Yes.
Hi. So the interconnection costs, is that mostly in the context of fairly remote sites where if you've got a couple megawatts of power, you're going to need to run a whole new dedicated line out to the brownfield, or are you talking about more of an urban context where there are nearby loads but maybe enough grid congestion that the utility is worried about how much solar they can accommodate?
Not the latter. I mean, I've been trying to do this on a landfill in Kings Park, Long Island, so obviously very high cost of power on Long Island. I think the most expensive in the country. But we just lost for the third time on this particular site the LIPA bid for a purchase power agreement because they felt the existing existing grid load at that particular location was already overloaded from another solar project that was not on a landfill, and they felt it would be too expensive to add another, I guess it was a substation we needed to add, and they just didn't want to pay for that. They didn't want, they didn't want to do that. So
that's like a grid congestion issue. Where the hosting capacity of the individual feeder is already maxed out, in this case by another solar project. So one of the strategies to deal with that, and this actually comes in part from another project on Long Island, though the Queens part of Long Island, there's a landfill in the rock.
Shalom, let me, your phone is really seriously breaking up. Is there another line you might be able to use? It's very hard to hear you.
Oh, okay. Why don't I come back to this question and I'll dial in with a different line.
That'd be great. And in the meantime, I'm going to unmute the rest of the people on the listening in, and Chris Carrick is in here, and he might have some insight on this as well. There's a couple names here I don't have phone numbers for, so I assume one of them might be Evan. Is that you?
Yes, I called in on Skype.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I got the right person here. And then there's one other person who is in here without a phone number. So who would that be?
Is that me, David Kay?
Oh, hi, David. Okay, good. Just checking to see who's here. So I am unmuting the entire attendees. Chris, are you there? Do you have anything to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I'm here, Sierra. Thanks. So my agency, the Central New York Regional Planning and Development Board in Syracuse, is working with 20 municipalities on a cooperative solar PV procurement project, and we have a number of closed landfills in our portfolio. Total portfolio is about 40 megawatts of projects, and the landfill projects tend to be larger capacity for obvious reasons. But we've had a number of discussions with the Region 7 DEC office, and they've been very encouraging about these possible projects. But I think they've been working on a sort of a guidebook similar to what Massachusetts put together a few years ago to how to advise communities and developers on how these kinds of projects should be developed. So we haven't seen that yet. We're hoping that will come soon. I don't know if Linda's heard anything about the timing of that guidebook. But what we've heard is really all that would be required is an amendment to the post-closure plan that the municipalities have on file with DEC for these projects, and, of course, a stormwater pollution prevention plan if the project is larger than 1 acre, which all of these are. So, again, I don't know, Linda, if you've heard anything or different.
Well, like I mentioned, you know, the big hurdle at the beginning of the 10-year process I've been going through was that it was exactly what you just said. The DEC was concerned about the old cover system. A lot of these landfills have consent orders in place whereby they were required to cover the site, but they're at different stages of at this point, degradation, right, because they're old. And so but the good news is that they're trying to make it simpler. and what you just mentioned, just, you know, taking that old consent order and that old maintenance plan and sort of updating it is they're saying the easiest way to go. The problem is you don't get any money for that. I'm thinking that a better way to go is to actually go through the brownfield program, because these sites are going to need, you know, a new cover, and the and they should be entitled to go through the new brownfield program, which DEC has agreed to, and because that program gives you, you know, a significant amount of tax credits at a minimum 28 cents back on the dollar of your project costs to do the new cover system. And then for your actual capital improvement, the solar farm itself, you can get, depending on the location of the site, between 10 to 24% back of that project cost as well, or three times the cost of the cover system itself. So that generally will pay for the fact that you're doing this project on a brownfield site and recovering the landfill. So while that guidance may be interesting, I don't think that's going to encourage a lot of projects. No, I have not gotten an update on the actual status of the guidance, but, you know, the brownfield program is just a better way to go for all different reasons. It also gives a liability release from the state, so that the party doing the project does not become liable for the actual landfill contamination under it. So that's another benefit.
Tom, I see that you're back again. Do you want to go ahead and weigh in on some of this?
Sure. Thanks, Sierra. Linda, what I was talking about before for the interconnection costs, there was a landfill in the Rockaways, New York City Department of Sanitation, that was preparing to be transferred to the Parks Department, and enough space for as much as 10 megawatts of solar. And that's a lot for LIPA to be able to accommodate into their grid. But there were a number of nearby loads so that we could put in a direct wire and offset the loads that LIPA would otherwise be seeing. So it looks like the same impact as, say, an efficiency program, because it's behind the meter, and it just looks like those end users are using less electricity from the utility grid perspective. So I was wondering if that's a strategy that you've encountered and that might help with some of those projects that are facing the higher interconnection costs.
Yeah, no, but I'd love to talk to you about it, because this project has stalled and we need a new idea. we really, at this point, we've tried three times on bids. And I also think the problem with this industry at the moment is these bids are just brutal, very expensive to go through for solar companies. And when you lose, you've lost all your investment in the project and the site. So I'm hoping there are more creative ways of doing this, as you said, a direct connection, because it's not, I mean, that's more distributed anyway, and it really should be the way we're moving forward in the future. You know, the New York utilities still don't like this stuff, so they sometimes get in your way. I think Con Ed is making an effort, at least, and coming around, but I've heard that it's still difficult to get the agreements and, you know, to work out all the details with the utilities. So when you don't get a PPA, it's a more difficult process.
Yeah, it's also a function of the procurement as it's defined by the procuring agency. So in LIPA's case, if I recall correctly, they originally did a reverse auction to set a maximum price that you can get for your PPAs. So it's, as you said, a very competitive environment in order to get those megawatts contracted. There's a brownfield site here in Washington, D.C., where the Department of General Services just put out an RFP where essentially they said
we're willing to pay X for someone to install solar on this brownfield site. And they got a number of very positive responses by contractors who thought that they could complete the job for the fixed price. So it's a very different procurement model and potentially more attractive for some of those brownfields.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we have to come up with more creative models than what currently exists.
Anybody else?
So, this is Jerry. I want to thought I'd just go briefly back to Lena's comments about the utility owning the projects. You know, we had legislation. In fact, it was initiated by our own state senator a few years ago to make it possible, actually, to expand, you know, community solar. In our area, we already had the legislation to allow power to be delivered to city electricity meters from our local project, and we wanted to see legislation that would allow other community solar projects here and across the state. The legislation finally passed. It was, however, eventually kind of distorted to become, you know, the kind of community solar that you're talking about in Virginia. And what, you know, even though California is a fairly high electricity price state, you know, when you added all of the costs of, you know, not just interconnection, but the cost non-bypassable charges is what the term that's used here, including and also transmission and distribution costs. You ended up with a community solar program that's basically unaffordable, and so it's going nowhere here in California. I really do think with respect to the brownfield sites that therefore, you know, it's probably a good idea to look at the possibility of microgrids, because you do have the opportunity then to, not have the utility, wheeling the power from the project site to the end users. And the economics could be better. And of course, you also have the option then to, add other bits and pieces on the site, including energy storage and so forth. The only other thing I'll say this while I have the mic. One thing I learned as an elected school board member in another part of California was that, you know, school systems typically have sites for schools that they've kind of tucked them away. They own them, they control them, and then they may or may not use them. And when they find out that they're not going to use a site, of course, that's a potential revenue generator for the school system. But it's also a possibility for, a project in the community that's convenient to a lot of energy users. So it's something I just thought of listening to the conversation here, that it might be something that would be worth looking at, add to the list. It's not a brownfield situation, but, add it to the list of possibilities for, getting solar in big chunks closer to the end users.
I see that John Walter's in here. John, do you have anything to add to this conversation? He's a solar developer out in California. John, are you there? Okay. All right, well, continue on. If John wants to join in, I'm sure he will. He may have been...
You know, on the microgrid issue, one thing that is happening is that I have been able to convince some developers of brownfield sites that, you know, have buildings to start to look at microgrids in, you know, as part of their building development. And so that is happening. There's finally, you know, a number of companies out there. I think the problem with microgrids right now is the confusion over all the different kinds of technology. What really is a microgrid? Is it, you know, combine heat and power with solar, and, you know, what is it? You know, it's sort of a new fun word, but it's I think confusing to the average developer. And how do you pick and choose, you know, the right technologies for a microgrid? So because this brownfield program is so – yes, go ahead.
That's definitely an issue. In fact, I, as a microgrid architect, that's my main role, is to help try to clear up that confusion and to be a resource for developers who know about real estate but don't know about owning energy infrastructure. I help them to navigate those choices. But I think you're right that in the context of urban development is some of the best opportunities for brownfields with microgrids. And there's a local example. Here in D.C., the old Mirant plant in Alexandria, a former coal plant that was shut down, as usual, partly for economics, but also as a result of community pressure because of the environmental impact of the emissions. So here in some of the most valuable land in the metropolitan area is this big multi-acre site right in the middle that's kind of a blank slate. It does have all of the cleanup associated with it, but there's opportunities for new high-density transit-oriented kind of development and potentially with its own energy infrastructure. There's probably not room for a lot of ground-mounted solar because the land is so valuable. But rooftop solar, definitely, and the combined heat and power and so forth, and there's no issues with utility interconnection there because, you know, they used to take 200 megawatts of power, so a few megawatts is not going to be a problem for them.
So is the microgrid going forward on that site?
Oh, everything is the very early planning stages. So it's one of the things being considered, but it's going to be years before we can answer that question, yes or no.
We did work on a microgrid at the Brooklyn Army Terminal. It consisted of, unfortunately, a lead-acid battery for energy storage, but at least it was energy storage, the first battery in the city to specifically serve that purpose for the electricity in the building and solar on the roof and then a building management system. But for some reason, the city of New York has not marketed that. And it's probably because overall, by the end of the day, it was not real economic. You know, it was while the solar ended up acting independent of the battery because we realized the building had such a high load. It's actually a 2-megawatt load building. And so the solar, we put 720 kilowatts per hour battery at the site. So that didn't, you know, even cover the building for, you know, the most busy, you know, the heaviest load part of the day. But so we use that during the day, and we use the battery at night to pull cheap power off the grid. And so it's been functioning fine. It just cost a lot. And the costs, believe it or not, were related to the fire department issues. We had to get a variance from the fire department because lead acid can, if it leaks, can leak you know, bad things. So we needed to have secondary containment in the basement where the battery is stored at fairly high expense. So the actual construction of the infrastructure to support the battery is what ended up making that project uneconomical. So the city has not really promoted it, but there is that example, and at least now there is a process developed with the fire department to deal with lead acid batteries. That was also a code issue where we had to, you know, get creative with the code and get this variance. But the code has been updated since then, so that's good. And now also can accommodate lithium batteries.
Does David Kay, could I ask a question?
Oh, sure, David, go ahead.
So this is, I'm sorry I missed the very beginning of this, so it might have already been addressed, but I'm wondering if you have any comments in relation to brownfields about scale of development issues. You mentioned 700 closed landfills. I'm assuming that was New York State data. And there's potential, but from your perspective as someone who's interested in developing, what of all those sites, like, would you have a wild guess about how many of them would be even possibly attractive to someone to develop on? And I'm asking that partly in the context of what I'm hearing to be a somewhat pessimistic read, which is on sort of the contribution that brownfields might make to the state's energy, renewable energy goals in the future over the next, you know, 10 years plus.
Well, EPA actually has a list on their website of all the more contaminated brownfield sites, the state Superfund sites, and this is for the whole country, actually, where they've actually scanned all the sites up front and evaluated their solar capacity. So I can give you that information if you're interested in it.
But I'm especially interested in your perspective on the developer and what they did. So.
I'm sorry. So your second question was about?
I mean, they did an analysis, which I would actually be interested in looking at. But what I'm really wondering is, is their analysis enough where they say, hey, this looks good for someone like you to be actually interested in trying to do something on those sites, or do they just do the very minimal kind of analysis that means that
they've done a fairly good analysis. They've looked at how close the connection is to the grid. They've done a good analysis. Those are the worst sites, though. You know, those are the really, you know, the sites nobody wants to touch. But at the federal level, EPA is willing to give a liability release for that to the solar developers. So that's the only list of brownfields that's out there. This list of all of the, or the this group of all of these closed landfill sites, DEC, you can, you know, through the Freedom of Information Act, get the list. But there has not been any, you know, statewide analysis of their potential for solar. You know, I don't know if NIDA sort of got that on their radar screen, but that same type of analysis has not been done at the state level. But as far as scalability, I mean, these typically are the biggest sites for this use, you know, I mean, and they're generally flat, at least on top, and, you know, they tend to have slopes where you can't develop, but they generally tend to be flat. And there's lots of really flat sites, the grade on grade in the Niagara Falls and Buffalo area, which, according to Buffalo, is sunnier than a lot of other places in the state, believe it or not. It has a lot of snow, but it also has a fair amount of sun. So they're certainly, I mean, I personally know where a lot of brownfield sites are for this use, just based on my years of working on brownfield sites. So there are definitely available sites, but the ones that are where there's been data collected are the federal Superfund sites that are really throughout the entire country. They've done this analysis. I think it's called their Sunfield site program or something like that. I'll try to look it up while we're having this conversation.
Thank you.
And this is Evan Hughes. Sean Flack again. Just to comment very quickly that for the solar applications, you're looking for the acreage of the brownfield site itself. But for other kinds of energy infrastructure and microgrids, what you're really looking for is a brownfield site that is contiguous with the loads that you want to serve for the microgrid. And it can be quite small and yet play a crucial role. So, for example, New York City is looking at a microgrid for the Hunts Point Wholesale Food Distribution Center in the Bronx. And there's a relatively small parcel, city-owned, that's a brownfield, and it's feasible to site the entire central plant to serve that whole peninsula on that brownfield, which acreage is available because it's a brownfield and needs the remediation. So it can be a kind of a key leverage point, even though the site itself is very small.
Somebody else had a comment here. Go ahead.
This is Evan Hughes. I had a question about whether there's any synergy to be obtained when there's a closed landfill that is already doing landfill gas as a product or could be doing that, and if the solar interspersed between wells tapping the biomethane would be a possibility. Has anyone heard of such a thing being done or considered?
This is Shalom again. For that same site in the Rockaways in Queens, we had actually looked at that, and in particular to use the landfill gas as a firming resource for the solar with a little bit of gas storage, so that then you could get capacity payments and so forth for the solar installation and make it a lot more valuable. Unfortunately, the landfill was too old and there wasn't going to be enough methane production for it to be worthwhile, but I think it's a feasible model.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot is being looked at with also, energy storage and solar to even out the power and just to, because the power, particularly in New York, is so much cheaper at night. So, and mixing that also in with methane recovery just makes the site more economical overall.
Yeah, just to reinforce that point, methane storage from landfill gas collection systems is probably, I don't know, off the cuff, a 20th of the cost of battery storage systems. So if solar plus battery is even close to making sense, then the solar plus methane storage would be fantastic.
Somebody just joined from an 865 number. Do you want to identify yourself?
This is Michael Walton with Green Spaces.
Oh, hey, Michael. Hi.
Hey.
I don't know if you have anything to add to the conversation. If you do, go ahead. Maybe it's...
We've looked at a couple of different options in terms of community solar on brownfields. One of them was working with a large, it's actually a Portland cement producer, and they have a cement kill dust field that. You know, they're basically responsible for owning and maintaining in perpetuity, but they also have like $500,000 a month electric bills. So it's pretty easy to provide a pretty strong case for putting solar on that brownfield that can help not only offset their electric, but also provide a little bit, if you can add storage, can also help with power quality issues to make sure that their equipment stays up and running.
Any comments?
Sounds fabulous.
Anybody else?
Yeah, Sarah, this is Chris again. I have a question about financing for solar, community solar projects on brownfields. We have one project in our portfolio, which is on a Superfund site, which has been remediated and covered. But I'm wondering if folks on the call have thoughts about whether it would be particularly challenging to get this project financed without waivers of liability from the municipality, or what would be involved in terms of the insurance and liability issues?
Well, that depends on the state, unfortunately, and the listing of the site. So is it a federal listed site or a state listed site? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a state listed site, and it's in New York.
Oh, it's in New York. Okay, so it's a state Superfund site. Well, if the site can get into the Brownfield Cleanup Program, even if it's a Superfund site, and get a liability release, provided there are no responsible parties left. So, in other words, there's not some big company to sue. and then the project developers can get the liability release through that program. That would be the best way to go. If there's no cleanup that's needed because it's sort of a closed out site, then there are potential ways to get a liability, at least, the state to write a letter saying you wouldn't be liable because you've done your due diligence ahead of time and you'd have to do a phase one investigation of the site and hire an environmental consultant to do that, but you can remain a non-liable party under both state and federal law. So there would be some legal work to do a project like that, under either of those two options. As far as insurance, environmental insurance, if you can get the liability release from the state, I have not used environmental insurance very much just because it is so expensive, and generally it's not worth the paper it's written on. There's so many exceptions, it's just not worth it. But there are unique situations where environmental insurance is valuable. It really depends. There's two types of environmental insurance, too. So the second type, which is cheaper, can be useful. That's where, the parties involved can't be sued by neighbors who are claiming that they've gotten sick from the site. That's the cheaper insurance, believe it or not, because there's so few of those kind of lawsuits.
Thanks.
I've got another question if no one else does. This is David again. Given the array of possible places that the renewable and solar in particular might be sited, what is it about a brownfield, given all the extra barriers, that makes them most attractive? Is it mostly the proximity to consumers, or is there something else that I'm missing?
Well, there's a couple of things. The size is good, so you can do a larger project. The zoning is typically good. In other words, they're commercial or industrial zoned projects, and these are considered, either commercial or industrial type projects, so you don't, that You don't have to go through rezoning like you do if you try to use agricultural land. There's also proximity to the load that typically is there as well, and even potentially some end users right next door. You know, there could be existing facilities you can directly buy the power. So there's a lot of reasons, and there are these tax credit incentive programs that are out there in certain states.
Also, sometimes the energy use is more suitable for the particular site. So clearly, with PV, if you use ballasted systems, et cetera, you don't need to penetrate the cap. But even other kinds of like central plant scenarios where you can just pour a concrete pad on top and you don't need to disturb the soil, while for other kinds of redevelopment, there'd be a lot more remediation involved.
Any other comments here?
Have we, have you guys already talked about the sort of different installation methods in terms of ballasted versus the pile?
Nope, not yet. Go ahead. Anybody?
So just for those that aren't as familiar, one of the nice things about the opportunity for doing solar on brownfields is that because of the nature of the system, you don't have to like dig footings and foundations, whereas if you were to build a building, you'd have to do that. So for the kinds of sites that have caps that can't be penetrated, you can do ballasted ground mount solar, which is essentially like a plastic bathtub that's filled with concrete, and then the racking is mounted to that, so that they don't have to go into the ground. And so that's, I guess, one of the other advantages to putting solar on brownfield is just that it's sometimes difficult, if not, or prohibitively expensive to develop other things. So if somebody wants to have sort of the highest and best use for that piece of property, sometimes that could be community solar.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, DEC's position is simply you can't breach the cap. So whatever way, whatever method, foundation method for the solar panels won't do that. Panels sink about a foot typically when they're put on landfills, so you have to take that into consideration. And then you have to make sure there's at least another foot under that won't, breathe. In other words, generally when a landfill is capped, there's a geomembrane under the dirt that's on top. So you can't breach that plastic. And so you're right, the ballasted systems are better because they don't do that.
So I've got a related question to that, which is, how stable is the landfill surface over the lifetime, in terms of whether it sags and so on over the lifetime of a solar system?
Right. You typically don't want to do it on a 10-year-old landfill. You know, the older, the better. It may not have methane, which was just discussed, but it's settled. So 20-year and older landfills are better.
Yeah,
however, there's some give with the ballasted system, so it doesn't, make that. Most of the landfills are older than that anyway, so they have settled. I mean, there's very few new landfills out there that are already closed, you know what I mean? There's very, very few.
For people who remember the name Solyndra, that was actually one of the advantages of their product. Because it was literally on a cylinder, the angle didn't matter so much, mm-hmm. so that as there was settling, it didn't change the output of their panels at all. But I don't know of anybody who has a comparable product today.
John Walter, are you around? I know you didn't answer earlier, but you might have some input.
Yes, I'm here.
There you go. Any comments or thoughts about any of this?
I know that there's been some banding around here in our local community, and Jerry's probably still with us here, about using the Yolo County, our county dump. It's one of those facilities where a portion of the dump is closed or closed off from additional, dumping, but the dump is still operating. So this would be the case where you're installing on an existing dump. Now, it isn't the closed portion, I'm pretty sure, is less than 10 years old because they're still recapturing gas. The early designs I've seen are ballasted systems, but with some, it's like the racking has, the posts have a like an expandable spring to keep the racks more or less level, because these are pretty rigid systems, and you can't have, they don't do well with a lot of flexing. So, but that was one design I've seen, but I don't know if anybody else has seen anything else.
John's a solar developer out of California. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just asking who the manufacturer is on that system with the adjustable posts. That sounds very interesting.
I don't remember. It was the design, and maybe it was just an artist design or an architect's design. Obviously just facing a problem and figuring out that's certainly one reasonable solution. So I don't know even that it's commercialized. That once you get to more, if the ground has already settled, then you don't need that. But if you're putting it on ground that's still settling or still likely to settle, you're going to have some way. And I've seen other systems. There's a great system from France that's a cable system, and they have their demonstration was stringing cables over a gorge and putting solar panels on it. Of course, the idea there is you have two. It's like having a suspension bridge. You have two substantial posts, and this gorge was probably 1,000 yards wide. So that's another design, and but there you'd in a dump environment, it's kind of like you would put the posts outside of the settling area and span the top of it. So it'd be one heck of a, structure. But again, that's another approach.
Interesting.
Okay, we have about 1 minute left here. Any other comments?
Okay. Just to say thank you, Sierra, for convening all of us.
Yes, I hope you all got something out of the conversation. On Thursday, 2 days from now, we're going to have a webinar with Samuel Golding talking about community choice energy out in California and a lot of things that are going on in that area, and particularly one of the aspects of it is integrating a distributed energy resources into a CCA, or CCE as they call it out there. So please, if you're interested in that topic, feel free to join. And thanks for everybody for joining. Thanks to the panelists for giving good information here, and I hope to see you all next time. We'll have another conference call in December. I'm not going to have a webinar in December, but we'll have webinars and calls back again in January. So thanks to everybody for coming.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Bye.